Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we are glad to have you listening. We're also pleased to hear back on the program Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician at Carle Clinic in Urbana. And every other month on a Monday, he is here, and we do this program we call Talk to the Family Doctor. The idea is that it should be a general opportunity to ask healthcare questions. We do, from time to time throughout the year, have specialists here on the program. But the idea here is because he deals with people of all ages, he sees grown-ups and he sees children, and he deals with people who have a wide variety of health concerns. This can be a general conversation about health, and I know that if you have questions, he will do his best to help you out. Always try to keep in mind, as I remind people when we do these medical programs, that we cannot diagnose over the telephone. There are certain things that he can't do because he cannot see you. And if you have a real concern, obviously you want to go on and pursue this with a physician that you can see in person. But this is a place that you can start and ask some basic questions about health. We do this these programs to add to your store of knowledge on healthcare. That's what we hope will happen. So if you'd like to talk with the doctor, you can call us here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's the local number. We do also have a toll-free line, and that means if it would be a long-distance call for you, use the toll-free line. We'll pay for the call, 800-222-9455. At any point here, you can give us a call. Thank you very much for being with us once again.
Thank you, David. Glad to be back.
Well, just in terms of news, we've talked about this with some other guests on the program, but I think, again, it's worth mentioning. We might talk a little bit about Gardasil. This is the vaccine that has been developed that protects against certain forms of the human papilloma virus. This is the thing that, among other things, causes genital warts.
Correct.
But also has been implicated, some forms of this virus has been implicated in cervical cancer.
Right.
And this is, I think now research on this has been going on for a while.
Right.
And now we have a vaccine
that has recently FDA approved.
Just been approved.
Right.
And so I guess one of the things that's interesting, and maybe that's the point it's worth making, is that now we've never, I think, that this is the first vaccine that has been developed to try to give people protection against cancer. Has there ever been anything like this before?
There really has never been a vaccination available on a wide scale, sort of public health basis to help prevent any of the known cancers right now. And I personally think that this could make a huge impact for the health of women in terms of significantly reducing their potential risk for cervical cancer. Cervical cancer in the past was a fairly frequent killer of women. The introduction of the pap smear led to much earlier diagnosis of cervical cancer, such that it was often able to be treated at an earlier, more curable stage. But one step better than good treatment is preventing the problem in the first place. And that's really the goal of most medical societies, is if you can actually prevent a problem from happening, that's much better than any treatment that you can provide for it. And in this particular case, the vaccination has received FDA approval as being safe and efficacious. It will not protect against all HPV viruses. There are literally a large number, and they had to pick a certain number that they were going to include in the vaccine. But they basically included the ones that are most likely to be associated with cervical cancer. And so it's estimated that perhaps we could see as much as a 70% drop in this serious HPV related cervical cancers.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things about this vaccine is it is expensive. Do you expect that most health plans, people who are in some kind of managed care kind of plan that covers various things like that, including vaccination, do you think it's going to be covered?
I think it probably will. Generally speaking, most of the insurance agencies will pretty much wait One, a medication needs FDA approval. Two, they usually wait for some of the specialty societies, in this case, the American Academy of Family Medicine, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists will all formally look at it, weigh in with their opinions. But I don't, at the moment, see really any downside to the large-scale introduction of the vaccination. And once those folks basically say, yes, this should be a recommended part of routine health care, then most insurance companies usually will then approve whatever it is.
Is it? Do you think that is the case that over time, as the vaccine becomes a regularly established thing and more of it is produced, is it likely that the cost is going to come down, or is it always going to be? It's like
It's close to $360. It's actually a series of three immunizations given initially, a month or two later, and then 6 months after that. And each one is estimated to be about $120. So it's not an inexpensive vaccination, but the long-term potential benefit it conveys is really quite invaluable. The cost, you know, the cost of manufacturing can indeed be lowered somewhat when you do large-scale production. There are some economies of scale, but in many instances, what drives the cost of many medications is simply the fact that it's a unique medication. It's protected by patent. Mm-hmm. There is no generic substitute for it, and essentially the company can charge whatever it wants for a particular medication or vaccine. The vaccinations themselves are in a somewhat unique position in that part of the cost of vaccinations, at least in the United States, is the liability associated with them. In the pediatric arena, there have been concerns that certain immunizations have caused autism. There are concerns that an occasional individual will have a bad reaction to a vaccination causing a problem. And the litigation associated with vaccinations for many of the manufacturers has been so expensive that oftentimes the cost of the medication has sort of insurance built into the price.
Right. Well, we have a caller here who's standing by. We'll get right to them. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. If you have a healthcare question, our guest this morning is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician at Carl Clinic in Urbana. First caller here is in Urbana, and that's line number one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. The latest issue of Consumer Reports on Health has two things that I'd like to one is to ask a question about, the other one is to comment on. The first was information about a new vaccine against shingles. And it pointed out that, I don't have the article in front of me, but something like 90% of adults have had chickenpox, and some high percentage of us will have shingles at some point in our lives. And as we age and our immunity level drops, the risk goes up. I was wondering whether this vaccine is actually currently available locally. Do you know, and do you know the cost?
I don't know the cost, but yes, it is available locally. And you're correct. Most folks, as they go through childhood, at least up until recently, encountered chickenpox and had the illness. The virus actually never leaves the body. In most folks, it's never reactivated, but in a small number of individuals, as a percentage of the population, but it still turns out to be a fair number of people, the shingles is the reactivation of that chickenpox virus in our body. The virus lives in one of the nerve roots of the spine, and in some instances, either just age and lack of immune suppression, sometimes associated with some other illness, some kind of trauma or surgery, some kind of stressful event will trigger the reactivation of the virus. And then you get a really painful nasty chickenpox-like rash, usually in a band. It's most commonly seen in the thorax, and you'll sort of have a band-like distribution of this rash that will last several weeks. You can treat the acute episode of shingles with, generally speaking, antiviral medications and anti-inflammatory type of medications. But a small percentage of people who develop shingles, even after their rash goes, continues to have pain along the nerve fiber that it was originally in. And these people can be pretty miserable, and trying to prevent that is a reasonable thing to do. The vaccination will help prevent reactivation of the chickenpox virus. It has indeed been approved. It's not out in large-scale use yet, so actual hard data on its effectiveness won't be probably available for a couple of years.
I think they were recommending it in this article for people 60 and over.
Correct, simply because with age, our immune system tends to decrease and allows reactivation of the virus. But in fact, you can see shingles at almost any age. We have seen it in adolescents, young adults, as well. It's just not as common as it is in the older folks.
And my second comment is about the cover story on this issue, and that was on men's health and why it is that men have died more frequently than women. And it was pointing out that men take care of their cars far better than they do their bods.
That's very true.
And had a whole checklist of things. But in glancing through it, I found some things that affect me as a woman as well. And I thought it was, I hadn't seen this information done so nicely and clearly. In fact, I scanned a part of the article and sent it to some women friends. And it's about insulin resistance syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't understood a bit about triglycerides. I myself have to get my triglycerides down some more. I'm now on Lipitor, and things have come down quite a bit. But I was always paying attention to HDL and LDL and the triglycerides. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm just beginning to now figure out that why people are concerned about those as well. But the in its little chart inset that it has on this whole article for men, and specifically about insulin resistance that can lead to diabetes and heart disease, and it says probably dementia. Dementia really gets my attention. The first thing that they give as a risk factor is your waist circumference.
Right.
And they don't do this BMI stuff. Who has time to figure out the BMI? It just says women who have a waist more than 35 inches, that's me, and men more than 40 inches, and then it tells you how to measure your waist.
Mm-hmm.
Because you know, a lot of men have waist sizes that they their pants that they wear their waist below their bellies. If you look at their, so I have a feeling that they're not measuring their waist the way they ought to be. And then it gives triglycerides and the levels and HDL and blood pressure and then fasting blood sugar. But it starts out with waist circumference. You know, that is something we can all check.
Which is a reflection of what is referred to as truncal obesity.
Right.
And basically, the more of that there is, the more likely, statistically, someone is to fall into that category of insulin resistance syndrome where their blood sugar tends to be higher. Anything that raises your sugars tends to raise your triglycerides. There's also a correlation between that and your cholesterol. The extra weight is associated with an increase in blood pressure. And also, those things are thought to be associated with an increase in inflammation in the blood vessel walls themselves. This is why the heart disease becomes much more prominent, because these are all the underlying risk factors for heart disease. Then you throw in some of the environmental factors. You know, does the person exercise or not? Do they smoke? Their family history. Dementia is, in this particular case, thought to be vascular related. Again, damage to small blood vessels in the brain, eventually leading to poor function of the brain, and should be differentiated from the other kinds of dementia like Alzheimer's, which is not necessarily associated with this.
Well, you can have multiple things going on with dementia at the same time.
You sure can.
But another point, this isn't in the chart, but something else that's in the text that surrounds this little inset. It says that men can show signs of impotency before they realize they have diabetes. And, you know, you see one of the things you get in spam is all these things about Viagra. And you really wonder whether men and women in their lives are realizing that signs of erectile dysfunction can be signs, usually are signs of something far more serious, and that just taking Viagra is not going to, we should be paying attention to the underlying signs and preventing them in the first place.
That's exactly right. And I can think in my own practice here just recently, I had a gentleman come in whose primary complaint was just that, erectile dysfunction. But in terms of going through the rest of his medical history, he had a variety of other cardiovascular risk factors. And even though he had not yet had any worrisome chest pain, we talked about the fact that now that he had this additional symptom, that this could indeed be a reflection of poor vascular health. And to make a long story short, he ended up with a five-vessel bypass after we found out that most of his coronary arteries were significantly blocked and he just hadn't had symptoms yet. He himself was probably somebody whose first symptom in terms of heart disease was probably going to be a heart attack. So you're exactly right. If that is an issue, that should be addressed from a global perspective by that person's physician.
We seem in this country to be expecting cures and wanting to put research into and money into fixing things after they happen. But it seems to me that you can't fix small blood vessels. You can't. There's some things you can't really fix once the damage is done. And as a country, we need to find ways to get our own individual heads around what we as individuals can take responsibility for to prevent our getting to that major intervention.
I couldn't agree with you more.
Thanks.
In the United States, the treatment of heart disease is bypass surgery, which is waiting 50 years to fix a problem that should have been prevented in the first place. But to be perfectly honest, a lot of the responsibility for that prevention falls with the individual because it's not rocket science. We know what it takes from a diet and exercise standpoint to keep your weight down, to keep your blood pressure down, to keep your cholesterol down, to keep your blood sugar down. And these are the underlying risk factors for heart disease. And again, just the environmental things. Do you smoke or not? I mean, if you wanted to look at the number one contributor to poor health, it would be tobacco. And so, you know, there isn't any cure for that other than having each individual take responsibility for their health and stop smoking.
Our guest this morning, Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor over at Carr Clinic in Urbana. And every other month on the program, always on a Monday, he's here. We talk about health. And if you have questions, I know he will do his best to respond to your concerns. And we have a couple of people here standing by, ready to go. So let's get back to the phones. And next will be Champagne and line two. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I live in Southwest Champaign. And Southwest Champaign seems to have a flood of geese. And there is a local flock, about 24 to 30 birds, that sometimes parade in backyards and up and down our streets, dropping their droppings. And I was thinking that, you know, I really perhaps should talk to my council person and see if this is something the city would want to take on in terms of moving them to a wilder environment than Southwest Champaign. And I wondered, is there any connection in, you know, they're talking about bird flu and West Nile disease, and which, you know, seems to attack birds as well. And is there any health risks that are known for wild bird flocks, which are no longer wild?
You ask a very good question, and I'm not sure that I'm the definitive person to answer it. I personally am not aware of the two things that you mentioned, bird flu or West Nile, necessarily being carried by geese.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know that for a fact. All I can tell you is that I have not heard that within the, you know, the literature that I've reviewed, mm-hmm. that geese are a primary carrier of either of those.
Well, that's comforting to know, and I suppose I should talk to the natural science department and or biology and find out more information.
Somebody through perhaps the U of I Veterinary School might be actually a good source of information for that.
Good. The U of I is usually very willing to answer questions that people have about their specialty. So
you bet.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
And one last question, sir. What is shingles?
Shingles is the common name given to the reactivation of chickenpox later in life.
And what does it look like on the skin?
It is a band-like rash that looks like a bad case of chickenpox, but it's usually restricted to just one side of the body in just a band-like distribution.
A band being like a rubber band, just a circular...
If you simply drew a line, say, from the center of the chest and went, you know, around the, usually it's on the trunk, around the trunk back to the backbone, and it would be a couple of inches wide, and would simply be a strip of skin that is involved with this rash. And shingles is simply the common name given. The medical name is herpes zoster.
Well, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. And it is, even though just about, at least before there was a vaccine for chickenpox, pretty much everybody got chickenpox, everybody does not get shingles.
No.
It's only a relatively small percentage of people get shingles. And I think it's also the case that for most people, you have one outbreak, and it only happens once.
Very, very rarely happens more than once. And if it does, it raises serious questions about the status of that person's immune system.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Next, we go to Urbana, and this is a caller on line 3. Hello.
Hi. I had a question between the connection of mercury content in vaccinations and autism. I asked the doctor. They said that the purpose of putting mercury in the vaccinations was simply for preservation, a preservative of sorts.
Correct.
But I wondered why they put such a poisonous heavy metal in to preserve vaccines in the first place.
Simply because it was a cheap, readily available preservative that was very effective. This question has been raised and been looked at a number of times. They have been unable to identify any ill effects related to the tiny amount of mercury that at least in the past have been in vaccines. But because of those concerns, most manufacturers are indeed moving to some other type of preservative, and it's anticipated in the very near future that there won't be any mercury-containing vaccines anymore.
I see. So there is no data hard data that links autism with the mercury content?
That's correct.
I see. Thank you much.
All right. Thank you. Vermilion County is the next caller here. Line number 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I've known two people just recently diagnosed with rotator cuff. I mean, older women, and also described as bicipital tendonitis. What is the recommended treatment and outcome of such a condition?
The two things that you just described are separate entities, so they're not the same thing. Okay.
Uh-huh.
The rotator cuff is a group of muscles that essentially holds your arm in place on your shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
If you compare the different kinds of joints in the body, your hip is referred to as a ball and socket. There is a bony cup, and there is a bony prominence that fits into it. But because it's inside a bony cup, it can only move a certain amount of distance in any given direction.
Right, while the shoulder bone or the arm bone can move quite a lot.
Exactly, because there really is no cup that the arm bone is inserted inside. It's simply held to the side of the body by a whole group of muscles that, you know, you would refer to as your shoulder muscles. And that's what allows you to basically throw a ball with your arm while you can't get your leg to do that particular maneuver because of the limitations of how the joints build. Given that the
inflammation of the tendon has, in my case, has been there for over 6 months.
Mm-hmm. And bicipital tendonitis simply refers to an inflammation in the tendon of the biceps muscle, which is not part of the rotator cuff.
I see.
It is indeed one of the muscles of the upper arm that inserts into the shoulder, mm-hmm. but is not part of the group of muscles included in your rotator cuff. If you had something out in front of you that you were holding in both hands, and then you simply at the elbow bent and lifted your arms up toward your body, you'd be primarily using your biceps. For weightlifters, this would be a curl. And that's primarily your biceps muscle. When you think of your rotator cuff, the muscles that allow you to throw a ball are the ones that you are primarily interested in. Okay? But both any set of muscles can become inflamed, and most of the time they do so because of either direct injury or simply repetitively putting more and more strain on it. This is why you read in the sports page all the time about big league baseball pitchers out on the disabled list with a rotator cuff problem. Huh? Exactly. But in fact, with simply age, muscles, if they're not kept strong, can get weaker and be much more easily strained, and especially with any type of repetitive activity. And typically, resting, icing, anti-inflammatory agents, cortisone injections, physical therapy, and in a few cases, surgery. But most of these are annoying, but eventually settle down.
But strengthening the muscle is the main component of recovery, you would say.
Yes.
And how safe is it to take anti-inflammatories on a daily basis?
Well, it depends on, one, the dose, and two, how long you're planning on taking them, and three, do you have any other medical conditions that might potentially be affected by those medications? For an otherwise healthy individual, the short term, and by that I mean a couple of weeks, use of an anti-inflammatory agent generally isn't a big problem. The most common problem related to taking anti-inflammatory agents is stomach upset, so we always tell people to take it with food to minimize that chance. But some people who are sensitive to the medication can find that they'll have some stomach trouble if they take large doses for any length of time. And some individuals who have high blood pressure, the anti-inflammatory agents can worsen their blood pressure. For diabetic patients who have some kidney-related issues, the anti-inflammatory agents can be a problem for your kidneys as well.
Yeah, so they shouldn't be used indiscriminately.
No, not at all. And in fact,
well, that's my feeling too.
If you're going to use it more than a week or two, it's perfectly reasonable to have your physician review your other medical conditions and make sure that it's not going to be a problem.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. And let's see. We have another caller here, and they are in Urbana, and it's line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
My mother has recently been diagnosed as pre-diabetic. She's 72 years old, and her father had diabetes. And I'm wondering, what does that mean? Does she have diabetes, or is she going to get it? If she watches her weight and watches what she eats and exercises, will she not get it? And does that make me more susceptible to get it?
Sort of working backwards, yes, you are more susceptible because it's in your family history. There are genetic predispositions to diabetes. Diabetes tends to become more common as you get older. It also tends to become more likely to occur if you're carrying extra weight. We hope everybody gets older. That doesn't mean that you have to get heavier. Pre-diabetes is part of the American Diabetes Education Program of the general public to make everybody aware of the fact that there really is an epidemic of diabetes going on in the United States, primarily related to extra weight. The American society is getting much heavier, physically less active. This certainly predisposes toward the development of diabetes. On a real simple basis, the fat cells in our body don't allow insulin to work as well as it should in our system. So if you don't have effective insulin in your system, you have harder time controlling your blood sugar. And consistently elevated blood sugar readings, basically a fasting blood sugar above 125 consistently, is considered the sort of biochemical definition of diabetes. In the past, the upper limit of normal for a fasting blood sugar was 110, but recently that has been lowered to 100. So now we have a whole bunch of people whose blood sugars are somewhere between 100 and 125. They're not normal, but they don't meet the definition of diabetes, and they're considered, quote, pre-diabetic. They have the potential, if their blood sugar creeps up a few more points, to be officially labeled as diabetic. But they also have the possibility of, with stricter control of their diet, some regular exercise, perhaps some weight loss, of moving their blood sugars back down into the normal range and not having it progress to diabetes.
All right, thank you.
Right, well, thanks for the call. And again, other people who are listening are certainly welcome to call with questions. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician at Carl Clinic, and he is with us every other month to do this show. We call Talk to the Family Doctor. Just for a second to go back to the question of the we're talking a little bit about the chickenpox and chickenpox vaccine. I remember back in the day, before it became common here in the United States, it was used in other countries, and I know there was this discussion about whether it should be required, basically, with all of the other stuff that we give to kids. And there was
it now is,
and indeed, and it now is. And I think that some people were wondering whether or not the vaccine would confer a lifelong immunity, or whether it's possible that if we then gave the vaccine to children, that then sometime later in life, we might have teenagers or people in their 20s suddenly developing chickenpox, and maybe there was some question about whether or not it would be a good thing for people to get a booster sometime later. So, have we been giving this vaccine long enough so that we have an answer to that question? Does it indeed confer lifelong immunity?
We don't know.
No.
There currently isn't a routine recommendation for giving a booster. So at the moment, we are proceeding as though it does confer lifelong immunity to chickenpox. One of the other questions that was hoped to be answered with the vaccine as well was, well, if you prevent somebody from getting chickenpox, will you prevent them from getting shingles later? And the answer is no.
Oh, so even if you get the chickenpox vaccine and then you don't get chickenpox, it is possible that then later in life you might still get shingles even though you never had the chickenpox.
Right.
Well, that's
life
that's
isn't perfect.
Batting 500, I guess. Yeah.
Life isn't perfect.
Well, yes. I suppose it's still better. Well, you know, this maybe also raises a question about chickenpox, because I think that, again, when we were talking about should chickenpox vaccine be required, I suppose some people said, well, chickenpox is kind of a nuisance disease, but it's not, generally speaking, not fatal. So should we? I think there was a time when doctors were saying to parents, if you want to get the vaccine for your kids, fine. If you don't, well, okay, it's up to you.
Right. And the same is still true for all vaccines. Now, the school system does indeed require that children be immunized or provide a statement that says the parents, for usually religious reasons, refuse vaccination. And you can still get into school then without being vaccinated, but there's this extra step that the parents have to go through. But from the state standpoint, the diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus, hepatitis, hemophilus influenza, pneumococcal vaccinations, now chickenpox, measles, mumps, rubella, all of these are standard recommended immunizations and also required for entry into school on a routine basis. There's always a period of time, it seems, between when a vaccination comes out and it's simply available. And usually a few years later, there's enough information and data on it for then the state and the school systems to decide, well, should this be required of everybody? Mm-hmm. Now, like the Gardasil vaccination that we were talking about, this isn't something as such that is contagious in a school setting. It's, you know, I can't see it being required by the schools. You don't need it to go out for sports. You know, there aren't any school activities for which Gardasil is going to present a public health benefit. That doesn't mean it's still not a good idea to have it, but I don't see it falling into the category that it's going to be required by school. In terms of the chickenpox, it now is required, and consequently, we see a lot less chickenpox. People did have the impression that chickenpox was, as you say, just sort of one of those nuisance little diseases of childhood. But like with most illnesses, there's always a spectrum of disease. And there are people who said, oh, yeah, I had chickenpox. You know, I had three little spots. And that was it. It was no big deal. At the other end of the spectrum, there are people who have varicella pneumonia. There are people who have varicella encephalitis. There are, in fact, children who die from chickenpox. It's rare, you know, one in a million. But if you have a population of 100 million children, one in a million turns out, well, there's 100 kids who are going to die because of chickenpox. It's a very, very rare event. But you can actually make that less if you vaccinate everybody. This is perhaps another good example of that is the polio vaccine. The polio vaccine used to be a live virus, and it was given orally, and it was a weakened virus, but you would actually take the actual virus into your system, your body's immune system would respond to it, and you would build up immunity to it. In the United States, actual cases of polio became so rare that, in fact, the only cases of polio being seen were in individuals who were immunized, whose immune systems didn't respond appropriately. And there were probably no more than a half a dozen cases a year of children actually getting polio from their vaccination. Well, that was still half a dozen more than were occurring otherwise. So there was a change. Now we use an injectable inactivated polio virus so that there can't be any cases given to children from the vaccination itself. And the question is, why didn't you do that before? It's not quite as effective as the other one. But in a population where you're not being exposed to it, it's good enough.
Mm-hmm. About 15 minutes left, a little bit less in this part of Focus. We have another caller here and have time for others, so if you want to talk with the doctor, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Line 1, Champaign, is next.
Yes, mm-hmm. Good morning. I was listening to your list of things that we now immunize children against, which, of course, since I'm 69, our immunization was much more truncated. I think it was just pertussis and diphtheria and one more. Mike, I heard you say hepatitis, and I thought, do we vaccinate children against hepatitis? And is that hepatitis A, B, and C protection?
Good question. It's hepatitis B. Hepatitis B is acquired from mothers who have hepatitis B and are carrying the virus, so it can be directly transmitted to the newborn.
And what is the difference? I know that C is in a whole different category, but what are the differences between hepatitis A and B?
Hepatitis A is generally an acute, self-limited illness obtained by individuals who come in contact with contaminated food or water. And so it'll make you really sick, and you generally will get better. And it's not typically associated with long-term liver damage. Now, there is a vaccination for hepatitis A, and it's frequently recommended to travelers who are going to go to countries where the safety of the food and water is questionable. Recently, there has come out a recommendation to make hepatitis A a standard vaccination for children as well. This is a new enough recommendation that it is not yet a required vaccination for school. So it falls into that sort of window where parents can sort of decide, gee, you know, do I think it's a worthwhile thing to do or not? The incidence of hepatitis A in our immediate community is quite low in children. Hepatitis B and hepatitis C differ from A in that they can cause permanent long-term damage to the liver and in some cases can be fatal. And so protecting against something that can cause permanent liver damage is considered a reasonable thing to do. Hepatitis B can be transmitted from an infected mom to their newborn, so newborns are currently immunized against hepatitis B. There really isn't a vaccination yet for hepatitis C, and most of the hepatitis C cases seem to be associated with either blood transfusions, intravenous drug use, things that, at least for children, don't seem terribly likely for them to come in contact with.
Right. And what is hepatitis B? Where does one acquire hepatitis B? How would one acquire?
If you don't get it from your mom, it can be a sexually transmitted illness. It can also be transmitted in any type of blood or bodily fluid that contains the virus.
And it is not as deadly as hepatitis C?
Generally not, but still in and of itself can cause permanent liver damage if let go.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Let's go on to another Champagne caller. Oh, you want to follow up on that?
I did want to make one mention. The caller mentioned pertussis, which is commonly referred to as whooping cough. And it was indeed one of the earliest vaccination successes. And it was felt that this was one of those things that you could be immunized as an infant and never need another vaccination for. And interestingly enough, that's not turning out to be true, because there have been more cases of pertussis in adults recorded of late. And so the standard recommendations for immunizations for adults have changed recently. Most people were aware that they were supposed to get a tetanus booster every 10 years. It's now recommended that their pertussis be updated on that same schedule. And there is a vaccination currently available that combines the pertussis and the tetanus in a single shot. So people who don't like shots won't have to get any more shots, but they will actually get protected against both.
All right. So when people come in, hopefully they'll be on that regular schedule. So probably whenever you're due for your update on your tetanus,
yes,
probably now you're also going to get a pertussis.
At the same time.
At the same time.
With the same injection.
One shot.
Right.
Okay. Very good. Next, someone else in Champaign, line two. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I just have a very general question about a diabetic diet. Can you tell me what is basically on the do not eat list?
There actually really isn't anything on the do not eat list. It's simply a question of, you know, how much, how often. The American Diabetes Association publishes some standard information on diet, and it generally just varies with the number of calories per day that you should have. And so, as such, there really isn't anything that you have to avoid. Now, diabetic patients, you know, readily learn that something extremely sugary or sweet gets into their system very, very quickly, and there are adjustments that they need to make for that. But many sophisticated diabetic patients have learned, well, gee, you know, I had that donut for breakfast. I need to go for an extra, you know, 20 minutes on my treadmill this morning to counteract that. Or, you know, I went to that wedding reception and had, you know, champagne and cake. I'm going to have to up my insulin at my next shot to counteract that. Now, obviously, a diet of donuts, cake, and champagne is not the ideal thing for somebody to be having, but there really isn't anything that you have to actually throw out of your diet for the rest of your life.
All right, so if you were at a pre-diabetic state or you were trying to avoid that, then are there any foods, you know, like carbohydrates that you should be avoiding?
This is really going to fall into the category of how many calories per day are you ingesting?
I see.
And then it will drop back in what form are you taking in those calories. Virtually any extra calories that you take in over the course of a day will be rapidly converted to sugar or glucose in your system and then ultimately converted to fat. So you could eat the world's healthiest diet, but if you're taking in 5,000 calories a day and you only need 2,000, that extra 3,000 calories becomes sugar and then fat.
I see.
Okay. So what you'd like to look at is the total calories that you actually need for a day, and then once you've defined that, what you'll find is that certain foods do indeed get rapidly converted to glucose, and others don't. And this is the difference between what people call simple carbohydrates and more complex carbohydrates. Your simple carbohydrates are indeed things that you would recognize as sweet or sugary.
Right.
But even white bread is, in fact, a very simple carbohydrate, and as soon as you eat it internally, it gets converted to sugar.
If you find that you are eating carbohydrates and then seem to feel sleepy soon afterwards, is that a sign of anything?
No, it's part of the metabolic process. But foods that get into your system and out of your system rapidly will tend to be much more noticeable to you than foods that are more slowly absorbed into your system. And that's where complex carbohydrates come into. Things that contain more fiber are more slowly absorbed into your system, giving your body more opportunity to metabolize it in a way that prevents rapid surges or increases in your blood sugar. So the idea is to get food and sugar into your bloodstream in a controlled, gradual way that your body can handle, as opposed to big spikes of sugar that your body will have more trouble handling.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. We are just about out of time. I guess we can try real quick here. Indiana, line four. Hello.
Hello. I don't think I'll take up the time, David. It's a rather lengthy question.
Okay.
So,
well,
another time then.
All right. Very good.
Thank you.
One thing I thought I would just ask real quick, some people might have seen this in the news, but I guess there are some doctors that have concerns about the use of acetaminophen.
Mm-hmm.
Tylenol is probably the best known
kind.
It's available over the counter as a pain reliever, and it's a fine medication,
right.
You know, no problem with that. But I guess that there are some concerns that if you take too much of it, it can be bad for your liver.
I just had a lady in the hospital with this.
Really?
Yes.
Okay. Well, okay. What sort of guidelines would you suggest for people if they are going to use this?
Okay. Tylenol has always been regarded as being, quote, safer than aspirin or other anti-inflammatory agents because it didn't irritate your stomach, didn't cause kidney damage, and is still, I would consider, one of the safest medications out there. But like anything, if you overdo it, I mean, water's safe unless you drown in it. You know, anything can be hazardous if it's not used correctly. And the biggest problem that people get into is they're simply taking too much acetaminophen or Tylenol in the course of a day, and they're doing it on an ongoing basis, and it does cause liver damage. In fact, if you look carefully at the number of liver transplants that are required for acute liver failure, not chronic, I have hepatitis and my liver's dying, but acute liver failure, you'll find that a whole bunch of those are related to Tylenol overdoses. And as such, you should not exceed what it says on the box. And if you were taking that amount, you know, the maximum amount that's listed for any length of time, you should tell your physician, and there are very simple blood tests that can monitor the effect on the liver.
Okay. And people ought to also be careful because Tylenol is in, particularly in cough cold medications that have a number of things in them.
That's correct.
It can be in there. So read your labels. Don't take that and then take more Tylenol on top of it because you might be
an excellent point because in many instances, people sometimes do not. They're simply not aware that they're indeed overdosing.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you, Dave.
Dr. Jeff Swearingen, he's a family practice physician at Carl Clinic in Urbana. Every other month he's here for the show. We do a call Talk to the Family Doctor.